Hello, folks, and welcome to eLearning with E2R. Glad you can be with us. We're going to have a fun hour today. Alexandra's with me today, and we are going to talk about a subject that is dear to everyone's heart, certainly, because it's one of the most difficult aspects of managing people in the workplace, which is ultimately terminations. So hopefully by the end of our session today, you'll have some clear insight into some of the fundamental principles of termination. And of course, as you well know, we are available to all of you to ask us questions following the e-learning session, where we can provide specific assistance for any given circumstance that is currently facing you. By way of housekeeping, we remind those of you who are attending the live webinar that we encourage you to ask questions via the chat box at the bottom right-hand side of your screen, as we are unable to use the raise hand function. We will make our best efforts to answer all questions which are asked. However, if we are unable to answer your question over the course of this webinar, an E2R team member will be in contact shortly to set up a time for you to speak with an advisor. In addition, we remind all listeners that all of our previous topics can be heard directly by visiting our online resource at e2rsolutions.com. I can't think of anything better than to sit around the campfire, as it were, and listen to some of our previous topics. Lastly, we take this opportunity to remind all of you that the information contained within our webinars is by way of overview only. It's not intended to be a specific analysis from an employment and labor law perspective, and certainly we ask you to seek out specific advice to deal with your given situation. And of course, as mentioned earlier, please feel free to call us at any time about the subject matter of this webinar, or indeed any other previous webinar, and of course any questions that you have. Get your calendars ready. On October 27th will be our next e-learning session, and that is going to be, drum roll please, Human Rights in the Employment Context, What Employers Need to Know from Process to Emerging Trends. All right, so now without further ado, let's dig into Terminations 101, and I know we can all ace this course. Okay, by way of agenda, here's what we're going to do and the order we're going to do it in. We're going to discuss with cause terminations and without cause terminations. Those definitions are legal definitions, so we need to understand what they mean. We will then speak to statutory notice of termination, in other words, the legislation that governs termination across Canada. We will talk about that. We will discuss severance pay, which is specific to two pieces of legislation in Canada as it relates to an entitlement beyond notice of termination. We will talk about the common law reasonable notice, which is what the judges, the courts, have imposed on the employment relationship over many, many years that goes beyond what the minimum standards legislation provides, that statutory requirement. We'll talk about notice obligations for low-level workers. That has undergone a significant change recently as a result of some recent decisions, and now low-level workers are treated differently by the courts than they were previously. We'll talk about mitigation. Mitigation simply means how does an employee's efforts post-termination in securing alternate employment, how does that impact on the employer's liability, and does an employee have any obligation to seek out alternate employment following the discontinuance of his or her employment. We'll talk about the importance of employment agreements. They are absolutely fundamental. It will be self-evident once we finish this session as to why they are so fundamental. And then finally, the termination meeting itself, some tips on how to deal with the termination meeting. So let's dig in. In terms of the by way of introduction, the scope of this presentation does not, underscore not, apply to unionized employees. They, of course, are subject to provisions incorporated in collective agreements, as well as employees on fixed-term contracts. Right? We're not going to have sufficient time to discuss those, although please note that employees that are on fixed-term contracts where they are renewed, let's say on a consecutive basis, that can certainly give rise to much of what we're going to talk about today.
Okay, so when it comes time to terminate an employee, employers have two choices. There's only two. So you can terminate with cause or you can terminate without cause. So if cause is established, and keep in mind that cause is a very high threshold, and Stuart's going to get into this shortly, the employer can terminate without providing the employee with reasonable notice of termination or pay in lieu thereof, or typically any compensation in lieu of notice under a written employment agreement. Now, keep in mind that that's subject to employment standards, minimum notice entitlements, which may or may not be applicable. If cause is not established, so if we're going to proceed with a termination without cause, reasonable notice of termination or pay in lieu thereof, either pursuant to the common law or under the terms of any written employment agreement, must be provided to the employee.
So, and I think it's fair to say, and Alexandra can disagree with me if she likes, but the vast, vast majority of circumstances, and we're about to discuss the definitions of with and without cause, will be without cause terminations. Only in the most select group of circumstances will cause typically be established from a legal perspective, thereby permitting the employer to terminate without, in effect, compensation. All right, so let's talk about the with cause terminations. So if you do have cause, as Alexander mentions, well, then you're not required, right, to provide notice of termination. If you have cause, right, in determining whether cause exists, some of the questions that a court, and you have to do the same thing on your end, if you're considering, hey, we don't like what this employee has done, and we want to discontinue our relationship. Maybe we have cause. All right, ask yourself these questions. How serious is the misconduct? Is it something we simply would have preferred not to have occurred? The employee continues to fail to file the reports? Or is it serious misconduct? Is it some form of ongoing harassment? Is it some form of theft? Those are serious acts that constitute misconduct. What about the surrounding circumstances? If I hit somebody, we all are nodding our heads going, that's completely unacceptable in the workplace. But what if you found out that the person I hit either engaged in a campaign to provoke me over 2 years, maybe even threatened to do something to my family? In other words, what are the surrounding circumstances that caused me to act that way? That's going to be considered by a court. You need to think about it and consider it as well. Proportionality. If I steal a paperclip, it's completely inappropriate. I ought not do that. It's theft. Okay, we're all nodding our heads. But I'm a 10-year employee that took the paperclip. Is a discharge a proportional response to that act? You need to ask yourself that question. Let's move to some of the challenges associated with terminating for cause. As you can see by even the examples I identified, that it's extremely high threshold to meet. Really what the courts say, and think about it this way, most of the time when an employer terminates an employee, the court, often a single judge or adjudicator, likely in the confines of his or her chamber or room, is likely saying, yeah, they were correct to terminate that employee. I get it. I would have done the same. But the court's going to say, or the judge is going to say, I get it, but you still have to pay him or her on the way out the door. I'm agreeing. He or she ought to be terminated. But I'm not agreeing that he or she's disentitled to termination pay. Right? So think about it in those terms. So it's when you cross that threshold, if you get there, it's difficult to define, right? It's going to take significant misconduct, or as you see, building a case for cause. And that typically relates, well, often can relate to performance, but that's extremely difficult to establish. But you've probably heard of progressive discipline, which is a communication system to identify to the employee that it's unacceptable, the conduct. That potentially can lead to cause. So circumstances that will not constitute cause, right? To generalize, but just so you get your coordinates when you're thinking about cause. Performance is tough. If I come into work every day, it's going to be tough to terminate me for cause based on performance. Attitudinally, personality. Yeah, we don't like it. It's all obvious. But judge is going to say what? What I just said. Yeah, I agree with you. He or she didn't belong there. But you got to pay them. Right? So you're going to have to, if you're even going to have a chance at it, you're going to have to provide ongoing warnings to establish cause. Right? And typically, as it relates certainly to performance, give somebody the opportunity to demonstrate improved performance. Right? And certainly lack of work brought about by business conditions. Right? Economic circumstances will never, ever constitute cause permitting you to, in effect, exempt yourself from the obligation to provide termination pay to employees.
Okay, so now we're going to discuss without cause termination. So there's two sources of liability that we need to be aware of, the legislation and the common law. Now, for the legislation, all provinces have employment standards legislation that outlines what an employee is entitled to upon termination at the very minimum. So we're concerned here with statutory notice and severance pay where applicable, and we'll get into that more later. We're also concerned with the employee that the employee may be entitled to a common law entitlement. And again, Stuart addressed this earlier, but that's what a judge would award, which tends to be much higher than the minimums outlined in the employment standards legislation. Now, consider the importance and enforceability of employment contracts. And I hate to sound like a broken record, but this is something that we're going to mention again and again throughout this presentation. But you can take away the uncertainty regarding what common law reasonable notice is if you have an enforceable employment agreement that limits the employee upon termination to the minimums under the legislation. The story will then end with the agreement, the drama is over, employment agreements are very, very important.
Now, we were thinking of having some kind of background sort of music that you could barely detect and kept identifying, enter into employment contracts, because ultimately, just as Alexandra identified, it is really the panacea of your problems in the area of termination. It's the, arguably, the antidote is really what it is, right? And it's virtually foolproof. Okay, so let's talk about now statutory notice. So each jurisdiction, right, provincially and federally, has employment standards legislation in place setting out a variety of minimum terms of the employment relationship, including notice of termination. All right? So that's the floor. Whether it's vacation pay, statutory holidays, hours of work, overtime, termination, employment standards legislation sets the floor. You can always go, right, take the elevator and go up, go to a higher floor, which is really fancy, make really nice things, big chandeliers, right? But you have to have that foundation in the basement, right? You can't go below that, right? As it relates to probation, right? You see, as you see there, most jurisdictions provide that in order to be entitled to notice of termination, you have to have provided service of at least 3 months, all right? And bear in mind, quick little anecdote on that issue. If I say to an employee, your probationary period is 6 months, it's meaningless from a legal standpoint because if I'm in a jurisdiction, apart from New Brunswick, PEI, and the Yukon, if I'm in a jurisdiction with a three-month probationary period, once that employee has surpassed the three-month mark, the employee is entitled to notice of termination under the legislation. Doesn't matter what we call it. We could call it during your Twinkie period. Right? Doesn't matter that I've called it a probationary period. I'm entitled once I've worked for 3 months. Now, you see there's exceptions. Manitoba's only 30 days, whereas New Brunswick, PEI, the Yukon is a six-month period.
Now, usually employment standards legislation provides for a maximum of 8 weeks of notice after a period of employment of 8 years or more. However, there are some provinces that cap out at 4 weeks, New Brunswick, and 6 weeks, Newfoundland. Now, keep in mind that this notice can be provided as working notice or pay in lieu or a combination of both. So if I'm an employee that's entitled to 8 weeks of notice, 4 of those weeks can be working notice and 4 of those weeks can be pay in lieu. That's totally up to the employer's discretion. So totally up to you in that regard. Now, remember to keep your employee whole during the statutory notice period. So it's not just about the employee's base salary. So total compensation will include base salary, benefits if you're in Ontario, bonus, RRSP matching, pension plan, perhaps a car allowance. So you need to make sure that you check those employment agreements and your policies to entitlement to bonus, RRSP, and pension when you're trying to ascertain what your employee or former employee is entitled to over the statutory notice period.
Okay. Now we're going to talk about what is in three jurisdictions, federally, in Nova Scotia, and in Quebec. You have what are called, and it's actually rather surprising how many in the business community and even in the legal community are not aware of these provisions that exist. What they provide is a, let's call it a complaint mechanism for employees to allege that their dismissal was unjust. And if successful in making the complaint federally, Nova Scotia, or in Quebec, you can be reinstated and be provided with, in effect, all damages, including lost wages since the dismissal. So it is an extremely, a significant mechanism for employees in those jurisdictions. Even if you're going to pay them the termination pay or severance pay you owe them, a significant mechanism for them to say, hey, I don't like what happened here. I don't like it. I don't think it's right. I think I have a basis to complain that my dismissal was unjust. So it's very similar to what you see in collective agreements with unions, where you can only terminate for just cause. Very similar. And we're about to talk about a decision that, at least federally, that has seemed to put to rest any argument that it was something other than that. In Nova Scotia, you get that protection, but you have to be employed for 10 or more years of service. Federally, it's just 12 months of service. That's it. So after 12 months, if I work for a bank, if I work for a telecommunications company, a transportation company that's governed federally, Canada Labor Code, I can complain. It was an unjust dismissal. And then in Quebec, all I need is service of 2 or more years to be able to file what's called the Section 124 in Quebec to say, hey, you told me it's because I wasn't performing well. First I'm hearing about it. I didn't hear about this before, and thanks, by the way, for the good severance package. I don't care. I want to get reinstated.
So that leads us to our next slide, which considers the unjust dismissal provisions in the Canada Labor Code. So this is a Supreme Court of Canada decision that came out over the summer, and just so you're aware, before this judgment came out, there was this ongoing controversy about whether over the issue of whether federally regulated employers could lawfully dismiss an employee without cause under the code. So some adjudicators had held that the code did not permit dismissals without cause, while others disagreed. So there was kind of confusion around this. So the FCC considered this case. It dealt with an employee who was employed as an administrator and procurement supervisor for 4.5 years. He was dismissed without cause and without reason in 2009. So the employer quite generously offered 6 months of pay in lieu of notice. The employee didn't want to take this, and he made an unjust dismissal complaint under the Canada Labor Code. So ultimately, this went up to the Supreme Court of Canada, which found that an employer could not rely on severance payments, no matter how generous they were, to avoid a determination under the CLC about whether the dismissal was unjust. So the code prevents federally regulated employers from terminating non-managerial employees with more than 12 months of service. So that just confirms what Stu was talking about before, and now I guess the state of controversy as it relates to unjust dismissal provisions in the code is over for now.
Right, and for you sort of legislative policy wonks out there, I'm sure as most of you, right, sit down and like to look over legislation. But really what the controversy was about leading up made some sense, right? Because it says under the Canada Labor Code, as it does, quite frankly, all the other minimum standards legislation, an employer can terminate if the employer provides the notice of termination and severance pay as required under the Canada Labor Code. Okay, well that means I'm entitled to terminate people if I satisfy that requirement. So the employer argument was, well, if I'm satisfying that requirement, then, right, then isn't that all I need to satisfy? So they were saying, I can do that, right? I can do that. And the Supreme Court of Canada ultimately said, no, it doesn't permit you by simply satisfying the notice of termination and severance requirements to avoid the application of the unjust dismissal provisions. So that's where we end up right now with essentially now employees that are governed federally have a very vigorous right, now to bring unjust dismissal claims. Okay, let's look at severance pay now. So severance pay is a separate entitlement. I'm going to say that again, a separate entitlement because I know it can get confusing under the Ontario and federal minimum standards legislation. So let me say this again. In Ontario, you have a notice of termination obligation and a severance pay obligation. Federally, you have a notice of termination and a severance pay obligation. Two separate obligations. Those two separate obligations only exist in those two jurisdictions. All right? And severance pay is a lump of cash, okay, that you're entitled to over and above notice of termination, which, as Alexandra said previously, can be provided via working notice or pay in lieu of notice or a combination, right? So, federally, if you have 12 or more months of service and you're terminated without cause, 98% of all terminations, you're entitled to, and this is the infinite wisdom of drafters, the way they drafted this, get this, 2 days' wages at the regular rate of pay for a regular day's work for each completed year of employment. So remember that. It's governed federally. It's the greater of 2 days' wages per completed year of employment. So if I have 20 years, it's 20 times 2. That's 40 days wages, right? Or 5 days wages at the regular rate of pay for a regular work day. So it's never going to be less than, in fact, 1 day's, I mean 1 week's pay, right? So that's the federal. Let's now move to Ontario.
So in Ontario, the payments are much more substantial. So in general, two conditions must be met for severance pay in Ontario. So number one, the employee must have 5 or more years of service. And two, the employer must have an annual payroll in Ontario of at least $2.5 million. Now, keep in mind there is a Superior Court of Ontario decision out there that held that the determination of annual payroll should not be limited to the organization's Ontario payroll. And in fact, you should consider the payroll outside of Ontario. Keep in mind that is an outlier decision, and there is far more decisions that confine that calculation to Ontario only.
Well, think how, and Alexandra brings up a great point, think how scary that is, right? If that decision ever gains traction, and we don't know as of this point if it ever will, but if it ever did, for you folks in on with Ontario employees. It means that, arguably means that, an organization with a payroll of 2.5 million in the aggregate anywhere in the world. Anywhere in the world. So if you have one employee, right, with five or more years of service in Ontario, and you have operations in the United States or elsewhere where the payroll there is 2.5 million, then this decision says that you would owe severance pay to that employee under the Act, which is very, very far reaching.
So in terms of how to calculate severance pay, it's wages for regular work week multiplied by the number of completed years of service plus completed months of service as well. And also, please be aware that the maximum amount of severance pay, it caps out at 26 weeks of pay. Now, severance pay is also payable where an employee has five or more years of service and the employer terminates the employment of 50 or more employees within a six-month period if the terminations are caused by a permanent discontinuance of all or part of the business of the employer at an establishment. So keep in mind also that mitigation does not reduce the amount of severance pay owed, and severance pay must be paid in a lump sum within 7 days after the employee's employment is severed or on what would have been the employee's next regular payroll day, whichever is later. Now, the employer may provide severance in installments with a written agreement of the employee or the approval of the Director of Employment Standards. But keep in mind that the installment plan cannot be for more than 3 years. And there are some exemptions to severance pay, which include employees terminated for willful misconduct or construction employees.
And I suppose we should add this one point on that final point that Alexander raises on the issue of the exemption to severance pay for willful misconduct in Ontario. You notice that language, willful misconduct. Willful meaning intentional. I intentionally wanted and did engage in that misconduct. There have been a number of decisions over the years that have held that test is more onerous than cause. Remember how we were talking earlier on in the presentation today about without cause and with cause? So if you have a situation where it may be cause from a common law perspective, believe it or not, this is how complicated it can get, that cause may be insufficient to establish willful misconduct. So what does that mean, Stu? You're making my head spin. What that means is we're about to talk about common law reasonable notice. So that's what the courts award. So what can happen is a court could say cause has been established, but willful misconduct has not. So if cause is established, you would not get any common law reasonable notice above minimum standards, but you would still be entitled to minimum standards. So quick example, I'm a five-year employee, payroll is 2.5 million, right? I'm entitled to 5 weeks notice of termination, 5 weeks severance pay, a total of 10 under minimum standards in Ontario. That's 10 weeks. So if the employer alleged cause and satisfied the court that there was cause, but it wasn't willful misconduct, in other words, my performance, as you said, was so beyond poor over such an extended period of time with progressive discipline, et cetera, that ultimately, fine, the court agreed there was cause, but it wasn't willful. I just happened to be just so bad, but I showed up every day and I worked. It wouldn't be willful misconduct. So that's the interplay between the two. Okay, common law reasonable notice. There is no calculator to spit out the definitive number. That's the unfortunate reality for the business community, right? There have been many, many efforts by lawyers to try to say, here's the formula, 1 month per year of service. It never will ever fly. That's the bottom line. There simply is not a formula. So, given there's not a formula, what do those crazy courts look at? Well, they look at a number of factors, and as you see listed there, these are the primary factors. The employee's length of service, right? And the longer the length of service, the more significant the reasonable notice period. The employee's age, the older you are, typically the longer the reasonable notice period. Employee's position responsibilities, that's changed, and we're going to talk about that, but that will be factored in as well. The economic climate, are there great job opportunities, or am I now in Alberta and I'm not involved in the reconstruction of Fort McMurray? It's not going to be easy. Whether the employee was induced to leave a previous job, right? Did you induce me to come over by constantly offering me all these baubles to get me to come over? And I wasn't so keen on it initially, right? Ultimately, the underlying premise or philosophy of reasonable notice is to provide a cushion to that employee while that employee is seeking alternate employment. So as I mentioned before, this notion of a formula, the 1 month notice per year of service, you often hear that as it relates to managerial employees. The answer is it plays absolutely no role legally in the determination of reasonable notice. Many lawyers will still use it as a guide, and quite frankly, sometimes it's just easier to have it as a guide out there, but it is absolutely has no application from a legal perspective. The upper limit is generally, and notice it's italicized, and look at the asterisks and look down below. Approximately 14 recent Ontario cases have provided former employees with reasonable notice in excess of 24 months. In other words, that continuum that we used to say from 0 to 24, it's not 24 anymore. We're pushing that out to 26, 27, 28 months. In fact, there was a decision a number of years ago in Quebec that went to 30 months. So, sure, generally, but it's definitely the envelope is being pushed out. You can provide reasonable notice, right, by way of working notice or pay in lieu of reasonable notice or any combination thereof. If I owe you 6 months, I can give you 3 months working notice and I'll give you 3 months pay in lieu of. Absolutely acceptable. But remember that little gloss about severance pay. If you're in a federal jurisdiction or Ontario, severance pay has to be payable by cash. I can't work it out. You can't give the employee working notice and satisfy your severance pay obligation. All right? So what does it include if I'm giving pay in lieu of reasonable notice? It's going to be some of the items that Alexandra mentioned previously. Base wages, commissions, bonus, car allowance, right? The personal component of that. Benefit continuation and sort of all other compensatory aspects. In other words, whatever you would have earned, whatever you would have earned over the reasonable notice period, let's say 6 months from the date of termination, what would I have earned? If I work those 6 months, is what I'm entitled to.
So further to that, I'm going to talk about a recent case that's really made a splash in the employment law circles. So as you're aware, some bonus plans may be specifically structured to only apply to active employees who are still present at work at the time when the bonus is paid out. This case demonstrates that the courts do not always agree. So this case dealt with a senior associate in an investment bank division, and he was there for 8 years. He participated in short-term and long-term incentive plans, which made up approximately 60% of his annual compensation. Now, his bonus plan provided that no bonus would be paid if he departed, whether for cause or not, before the payment date. He was terminated for cause. The employee challenged this, and the trial judge determined that the allegation of cause was not supported and awarded him a reasonable notice period of 15 months. Now, during this period, he was entitled to the bonuses throughout the period, despite the limiting language present in the bonus plan. The employer appealed this, and the Court of Appeal upheld the decision of the trial judge. The judge said that the limiting language in the bonus plan was insufficient to deprive the terminated employee of the bonus that he would have earned during the reasonable notice period. So in light of this decision, it may be appropriate if you have bonus language in your bonus plan or employment agreement for you to schedule a call with us, and we're happy to maybe revise and update those in light of this bombshell of a decision.
So we don't want to get into the weeds of the legalese, as it were. But this is, as Alexander mentions, an important decision. But as of this moment, there's a significant distinction to draw, which is this. If you have an employment agreement right now with a termination provision that's enforceable, then very, very arguably, as of this moment, this Lynn decision, and there's a, at least another one as well, doesn't apply. What we're talking about here is if I'm entitled to reasonable notice of termination, say I'm entitled to a year because I'm a long service guy, I'm entitled to a year, and my bonus, right, my bonus, the terms of the bonus plan that I participate in, says that I have to be an active employee at the time of payout. And it turns out, at the time I'm terminated, it's not the time of payout. The payout happens 6 weeks later. Well, under the clear terms of the bonus plan, I'm not entitled. I'm not only not entitled to an accrued entitlement to bonus up to the date of termination, but not entitled to a, let's call it pro rat, or a bonus payable over the 12 months from the date of termination. That applies, or these decisions apply, where there is no contractual provision providing notice of termination. All right? So if you have a good contract, right, with a enforceable termination provision, there is a much different argument that would resist this, the principles that come out of this court decision to say, no, you don't get that, and I'm not going to slide into the legalese as to why. It's just how the court and the principles of how you award damages, right? That's what makes it different, and that's why, once again, do you hear us singing? Employment agreement, employment agreement. Boy, that is a lousy tune I just hummed there. But that's another reason why it's so important. Okay, let's talk about those low-level workers. And we were intimating that there is a change that has occurred with low-level workers. So historically, what were some of the primary questions you would ask when you were talking about an employee's entitlement to reasonable notice of termination? Well, historically, you'd look at the employee's position and job duties, and typically, if they were lower level, then that would play a significant role in minimizing, or at least decreasing, your reasonable notice obligation. So, what was the practical reality of the application of this sort of principle? Well, the reality on the ground was, if you're an unskilled worker, you typically got something, right, and around 12 months would be a max, somewhere in that range. So I could have many years of service, I could be a mature worker, and I'd be getting around something in the range of 12 months. Whereas senior managerial employees would get up to this 24 months that we were talking about moments ago. But what has happened is there has been a sort of a significant change in the approach. And the character of employment, i.e. this low-skilled versus managerial, let's call it, or higher-skilled, is really being diminished as one of the factors. It still is, but it's really playing a more minimal role. And as a result of a recent Ontario Court of Appeal decision, it would appear that really, at the end of the day, certainly in Ontario, right, but bear in mind, decisions in each jurisdiction have become more influential in other jurisdictions. That has just become part of the global village I think we live in now today, and everybody looks to everybody's decisions. So just because it's Ontario, remember, those of you in BC and Alberta and elsewhere, don't think that you're insulated because you're there. That's usually when you see, I'll call it progressive in quotes, decisions from courts. There's a tendency for other courts and other jurisdictions to seize upon that and run with it.
So further to what Stu was talking about, I'm going to discuss a recent case, T. Tomasco versus Crown Metal Packaging Canada LP. So we were dealing with a blue-collar gentleman. He had 33 years of service with the employer, and he was 62 years old, And following the termination, he had some trouble securing new employment despite inquiries and applications with 22 companies. So the employer at the time of termination provided 26 weeks of severance, accrued vacation pay, and benefits. So at first, the Superior Court of Justice heard this and awarded the employee 22 months of service. So this is a departure from the notice that we are typically seeing for low-level employees in the realm of around 12 months. So this went up to the Court of Appeal, which upheld the lower court's decision and reiterated that the employers cannot place undue emphasis on the character of employment factor.
So remember now, those of you who have employees, long-serving employees in unskilled positions, take a look right now at the liability that you might have. Let's say you're applying to terminate 5, and they were, say, mature workers with significant service. Take a look at that liability. It has now gone up dramatically. All right, at least in Ontario, certainly in Ontario, arguably elsewhere, but certainly in Ontario. So you have to give consideration then, and we're going to talk about employment agreements shortly, but you have to give consideration to entering into even employment agreements even with those long service employees. At least think about strategies to do that. All right, let's talk about mitigation now. So if I'm an employee, I've got 10 years of service, I don't have an employment agreement, or I have a lousy employment agreement with an unenforceable termination provision, then I'm going to say I'm entitled to reasonable notice of termination or compensation in lieu of. All right, what does mitigation mean? Well, mitigation means that if I'm an employee who says I'm entitled to 12 months reasonable notice, well, I'm not technically entitled to 12 months. I'm entitled to 12 months less alternate earnings from either self-employed activities or my employment activities over that 12 months. So let's say I found a job after 6 months that provides me the comparable rate of pay, or let's call it the same rate of pay. Then my damages, lawyer speak, in effect for what I'm entitled to, I'm only entitled to 6 months. Not 12, six. Because I found alternate employment that paid me the same as what I got paid before after 6 months from the date of termination. So it'll be offset against my award, right? So how does that play in real life? Well, here's where it gets interesting. One of the first questions you will always ask as an employer when you're terminating an employee is, assuming they're not subject to an employment agreement, with an enforceable termination provision, have you heard us say that yet? You're going to ask yourself, can this person secure alternate employment quickly? In other words, what are their mitigation opportunities? If they can, and we know they can, well, in the circumstance where I just identified the entitlement of 12 months, am I going to pay them 12 months? Heck no. If I think they're going to secure alternate employment extremely quickly, well, I'm going to, in all likelihood, design my severance package to reflect that fact. And just bear in mind, you always have to pay the statutory minimums, all right, just so we're clear on that, right? So if I think they're going to find alternate employment quickly, I'm going to lower the amount I probably am going to offer, right? And remember, when an employee ultimately gets some kind of award from a court, or even when you give them a settlement of some sort, they're going to have to repay EI if they collected EI benefits, because it will now be an overpayment, but the courts could care less what happens on EI. They don't typically get involved.
So now I'm going to talk about reference letters. And this is often a question we get, and I understand how hard this can be. And increasingly, employers seem to be wary of giving reference letters because they're concerned about any kind of liability coming from that. But our position is that the perception of that potential liability is inaccurate. And that a reference letter, it can be a great thing because it can provide assistance to a former employee in finding new employment, which is great because, okay, it's a nice thing to do maybe, but also because this is going to assist the employee in mitigating their damages, which could, you know, be very beneficial for the employer in terms of what we could potentially owe them. So be clear with departing employees regarding the type of information the letter will contain. Obviously, we're going to be very truthful in anything that's contained in the reference letter. But usually, even if an employee wasn't a great employee, typically there's one or two things that we can comment on in a positive manner. So we would just focus on including those things in the reference letter. Where cause is alleged, the reference letter must be carefully drafted, and obviously call us if you want some assistance in that regard, and we're more than happy to review those letters with you and help you out.
I'm going to answer, there was a very good question that was asked in connection with this issue of the reasonable notice and bonus. And the question that was asked was, would this apply to stock grants? In other words, if I have, let's assuming a vesting schedule for my stock grant, and that vesting schedule were to occur during the reasonable notice period, but in that stock grant it says, in the terms of the stock option plan, let's say it says very clearly that I'm not entitled to a vesting during the reasonable notice period. In other words, I forfeit all outstanding entitlement to my stock grant, to the vesting, right, upon termination. There is a very, very strong argument now in light of this Ontario decision, or Ontario decisions actually, that yes, the employee is entitled. Because, once again, trying to stay away from the weeds, but to give you the fundamental sort of philosophy or premise underlying this. When you sue for wrongful dismissal, which is what it's called, you need what you're asking for is reasonable notice or compensation in lieu of reasonable notice. What you're asking for is the court to award you all damages you would have been entitled to had you remained employed for the reasonable notice period. So, despite any language in a bonus plan or employee stock option plan, had I remained there, I would have had that tranche vested of stock during the reasonable notice period. So the court is saying now, we don't care about the limiting language. Because wrongful dismissal, the award for wrongful dismissal, or the damage award for wrongful dismissal, means you get everything you would have been entitled to had you been there. And had you been there, you would have received, it would have vested. So, now remember, so this is huge now for those that are not governed by employment agreements. Once again, you're going to draw the distinction, those that are governed by employment agreements with termination provisions. Okay, let's go to, on the mitigation, and by the way, it was an excellent question, and please call us because this is a very new development in the law. An example of mitigation, you've got in this decision quickly a press operator, 14 years, given ESA entitlements. The employer argues, hey, you didn't go and try to find alternate employment. So no letter of reference was given to the employee until just before trial. So what does the court say? Well, look, the guy went out and had 60 to 70 potential employers with no interviews. He was willing to look outside of Mississauga, which is where he was all the way to London. He clearly satisfied his obligation, right? Although no obligation on the employer to provide outplacement counseling, and that's true, right? You should think about, because if you offer outplacement counseling, you are hopefully minimizing the unemployment period and lowering your damage award. In that case, the employer was provided with 10 months notice of termination.
So one last time, I'm going to highlight the importance of employment contracts. So you, the employer, you can limit the amount of notice to be given to employees on a without cause termination with a clearly worded termination provision contained in an enforceable employment agreement. Now, whether or not an employment agreement is enforceable, it requires three things: offer, acceptance, and consideration. So offer is the written offer of employment. Acceptance is the key. The offer must be signed and returned before the employee starts. If the employee comes to work the first day and signs that employment agreement after they've entered the workplace, you're going to have some issues relying on that employment agreement down the line. You also want to be wary, and you don't want the employee to sign the contract the same day that it's given to them. We want to encourage employees to take those employment agreements home, read it over, review. They have an opportunity to seek legal counsel should they choose to, and then return that agreement after they've had some time to review it, but again, before they start work. So the consideration is the job itself. That's the benefit that is provided to the employee and renders the employment agreement enforceable. Also keep in mind that employment contracts, termination provisions must be equal to or greater than the minimum statutory notice requirements. So if you're listening and you don't have without cause termination provisions in your employment contracts, or you don't have employment contracts at all, call us. We can draft one for you. We can even assist you with trying to roll out employment contracts to existing employees. But keep in mind, you can't just give an employment agreement to an existing employee and have it be enforceable. There will have to be some kind of benefit provided to that employee. What we often recommend is some kind of signing bonus that is conditional on them, in which they only receive it if they sign off on the offer of employment.
Yeah, and that's and often one of the typical strategies that's implemented to have current employees enter into new employment agreements with enforceable termination provisions. But it can be a wide variety of, let's call it, additional enhancements to their current package, i.e., it can be as limited as, for example, let's say the current benefit package, group health package, provides for 3 massages. What if it could go to 4? Right? And that qualifies as consideration. That is a legal term that simply means value. I'm giving somebody something of value in exchange for their agreement to enter into the employment agreement. And typically the courts don't look into what's called the adequacy of that consideration. If the employee values that and is willing to sign, great. But remember, it has to be a voluntary process. Okay, let's talk about the termination meeting. And just sort of by way of intro to this, the courts have become very, very, let's call it, active in considering the manner in which the employee was terminated. And to the extent a court is of the view that the termination was conducted in a manner that compromises the employee's dignity, right, then the court will likely respond. Now, the court has limitations in how it can respond. By the way, at one time, courts used to add to the notice period. So let's say somebody's entitled to 12 months. They would say, oh, we don't like the way that termination conducted. We're giving the guy 15. Now, they can't do it quite like that anymore, but they do have some tools available to them to send the message to the employer through money, right? It's all about money. That the employer ought to have conducted itself in a manner that preserved the dignity of the employee. So, how do you do that? Of course, you want to have it in a private place. Terminating in a public place is not a good idea. Terminating somebody within earshot of other employees is not a good idea. Right? You typically want to have 2 people present. Right, the second person doesn't have to say a word, but the second person's presence is there simply to respond to any outrageous allegations that may be made subsequent to the termination by the former employee, i.e., in the termination meeting, my manager said, I was terminated because I have this ethnic origin of X. Right? So you would need the second person to simply corroborate the manager's position that no, that was never said. And of course, taking notes immediately following the termination meeting is also of significant value. Not only does it sort of memorialize what occurred during the termination meeting, but it's also tremendously advantageous as evidence in any subsequent hearing, because if it's made what's called contemporaneous with the termination meeting, you can actually introduce it as evidence. So you want to hand the employee the termination package, provide a form of explanation for the termination. And you do that because if you say nothing, you give a former employee the opportunity to make the allegation I just raised. Aha! It was because of my ethnicity they terminated me. Why do I come to that conclusion? Well, I come to that conclusion in part because no reason, none whatsoever, was advanced in support of my termination. Huh. I know why they were concealing it. That could be the only reason why they didn't advance a reason. So, you clearly can't advance a reason related to ethnicity. They're smart enough to know that. They just didn't say anything. So, you should say something, but of course, very briefly say something, i.e., you know, your skill set, although advantageous is simply a skill set that's not appropriate or on a go forward basis in our environment. Whatever is appropriate, but you say something about the reason for the termination. You can, depending on the circumstances, review the terms and conditions set out of the severance package, but typically the employee is not in a positive state to review those terms, and it's usually preferable the employee go away and then simply have it suggested to the employee that they call with any questions. Never, never agree to sign a release if it accompanies the termination package on the spot. Never, never, never. Just say, take it away. No, I want to sign. No, no. Refuse to take it. Say, I'm sorry, you must take it away and sign it following our meeting. Make sure the employee returns all company property, right? And typically, our letters of termination will indicate that, you know, we're sort of offering you the severance package conditional on the return of the property and the signing of the release, right? We'll offer employee options to collect their personal belongings. That's all part, by the way, of that dignity that you need to demonstrate upon termination. So you want to provide those options. Obviously, a very uncomfortable time for the employee, as well as, quite frankly, for the manager. So you want to try as best you can. What we haven't included here is sometimes because it can be a significant issue, and we can talk about it offline, as it were, is what you do about, of course, personal information on the network, right, on the employer's network. And that sometimes can create some complications, but certainly you don't have to, you're entitled to be present while the employee goes through it, right? The problem is when you do it, you're accessing personal information, and sometimes that's a little bit of a challenge, even if you have a policy that says we own everything. So you need to at least think about that. You should talk to us about that. Make sure the record of employment is prepared, right, and sent off appropriately. Make sure the employee has a safe way to get home, right, because you have an employee, of course, in an emotional state, so you want to make sure that's taken care of. So in the interest of time, and I know the bell is ringing, we're at our concluding remarks. So bear in mind, without cause terminations, right, hopefully there's an employment agreement. Look to the termination provision. Hopefully it's enforceable. And even if it's not, you might be able to use that as leverage in any negotiation. Always ensure minimum statutory requirements are met. Once again, it's a floor. If there is no termination provision setting out entitlements under the employment agreement, you have to figure out what the common law reasonable notice of termination entitlement is, considering those factors we identified before, and there are, of course, many others. Obviously, talk to us so we can determine what's appropriate, bearing in mind that mitigation component as well. For with cause terminations, right, it is a high threshold. Do you have enough? Think about some of those factors we talked about before, the severity. Are there circumstances surrounding it, right, in order to determine whether cause exists? And remember, even if cause exists, you may still have a statutory requirement, right? And even if you don't have cause, and even if you do, you may want to offer, right, something over and above. If you don't have cause, you're certainly going to want to, but you want to allege it, you can, and say, hey, notwithstanding that we don't owe you any money because we say it's cause, we'll give you some money if you sign a release. Perfectly permissible. Perfectly permissible. Right? And in terms of a former employee and their mitigation efforts, it's to your benefit to try to assist them in their mitigation efforts. By the way, one of the ways is you actually tell an employee, look, I've got these three employers that I know are hiring. Why don't you apply to them? That serves two purposes. One, if they do get hired, fantastic. You've just reduced your liability. If they don't, you can demonstrate that they failed to cooperate, right? They failed to cooperate and they failed to mitigate. And then finally, of course, that is not a typographical error that you see on that slide. Employment contracts, employment contracts, employment contracts, absolutely fundamental. It's like in real estate, location, location, location. So with that, we thank you, and I want to thank Alexandra for participating today. Gradually, I want to hear less of myself, and I'll hear more of Alexandra. It makes me happy, and I can eat my banana, which I've been staring at the entire time. So thank you all for attending, and we look forward to seeing you in October for our Human Rights one, and I know we're going to have a lot of fun then. Thanks.